dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
Tune to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Though wishes for peace, health, and happiness are everywhere during each December holiday season, for many people it's the most depressing time of the year, when we notice how little peace, health, or happiness is in our lives. And this holiday season in America is even grimmer than usual. Tonight we hope we can add a little sardonic laughter to your life as we look at some aspects of the relationship of health and wealth. Our first guest is a doctor who's been looking at some surprising studies about how greed, inequality, and lack of community actually damages our health and shortens our lives here in the United States. We'll also hear about a small town in western Pennsylvania that decided to draw the line on corporate rights to protect the public health. And in our second hour, Wizards of Money will take a hard look at the pharmaceutical industry and why it's failing to make a positive impact on health nationally and internationally. Last but not least, to spice up the mix, some satire from the Christmas Coup comedy Players.
Hold you alive in this darkness and midnight when the pot-bellied beast chase their unwelcome guests.
We'll open the program with a question: is this society making you sick? Mike McCormick in Seattle has the story.
And we are very lucky to have with us Dr. Stephen Bezarushka, who is a local physician here in Seattle. Stephen, I know you teach at the University of Washington, amongst other things. Tell me what else you do.
I work in local emergency departments. I'm an ER doc, and so I've been doing that for almost 30 years. Gives me a wonderful opportunity to see people with real problems and try and deal with them.
And on top of that, you also do lecturing locally as well as write articles for the local paper, for some national magazines like Newsweek, which is kind of where we're taking part of our tack today. You had written an article for Newsweek back in 2001 entitled, "Is Our Society Making You Sick?" And I'm hoping that we can start talking about that. Is this society making us sick?
Well, it depends on what you mean by sick. And so what I do is try and look at health indicators among countries and see how America does. And one such indicator is the average length of life that people in America or other countries live, a so-called life expectancy. Born today, at today's mortality rates, how long can you expect to live? And these numbers are calculated every year by the UN, by WHO, and of course, by the American government. And if we look at the so-called Health Olympics, that is the ranking of countries by this indicator, how long you can expect to live, we don't do very well. We're about 25th. We're behind pretty well all the other rich countries in any measure of this is. In any measure of health, I'm not, besides health indicators such as life expectancy, we could look at infant mortality, we could look at disability-adjusted life years, and we don't do very well. We are so far behind the leader that if we did something as drastic as eradicate all deaths from our number one killer, heart disease, kills almost 40% of the population, if we eradicated those deaths and kept the other disease death rates the same, we still wouldn't be the healthiest country in the world. Now, we weren't always this way. In the early 1950s, we were in the top five. By 1960, we were about 13th. And we've sunk as, I think we're probably sunk as low as we're going to go. We're 25th now. I doubt if we'll drop much further. But this is a disgrace for the world's richest and most powerful country that spends almost half of the world's health care bill. We spend 42% of all the dollars spent worldwide on health care, and yet we don't have much to show for it.
So it's not a question of spending then. What would it be a question of?
Well, it turns out if you ask the question, what makes a population healthy? And I think of Thomas Pynchon's quote in Gravity's Rainbow, if you can get them asking the wrong question, the answers don't matter. I would say the right question is, what makes a population healthy? Now, in really desperate poor countries, not having enough to eat isn't very good. So you have to take care of basic needs, enough food, shelter, some water. Once those needs are met, the basic needs of sustaining life, then what seems to matter most for how healthy a population is some measure of the gap between the rich and the poor, the most powerful and the least powerful. What that does, the gap between the rich and the poor, is indicate something about the social fabric of societies. Societies that share more, that value the quality of human relationships, that have a sense of community, are going to be healthier than societies that isolate people, that make you feel inferior because you don't have a lot of money, that humiliate or shame you because you don't rank in the indicators in society. Andrew Grove said you get what you measure. And so that's a real reflection of a society. What does a society measure? We never measure our standing in the Health Olympics, so if Andrew Grove is right, we can't get that. What do we measure? Well, every minute of every business day, we measure the Dow Jones and the NASDAQ. And that's displayed all the time. I mean, you can't get away from it. So we must get what that is. And what is that? Well, that is a measure of wealth creation. So we must get wealth. And if everybody gets it, it can't be wealth. Wealth is only something that accrues to the privileged in society. But if you structure society so more people get more of a share of the pie, they'll be healthier. So in the 1950s, for example, when we were in the top five, what was going on then? This was after the Second World War, and we had a massive program of redistribution in America. We had the GI Bill, and we had housing, the VA housing loans. We had these bills where people could go to school. And so the poorest segment, the poorest fifth of America, actually gained the most income during the 50s and during the 60s. And so because we shared the resources in America with pretty well everybody, we were much healthier compared to other countries. That's to me the important thing to say. How do we do compared to other countries? Every year, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention reports that America's health improved over last year. And that's true. Health keeps on improving. That's a remarkable thing. But the important thing is, do you give the gold medal in the Olympics to the person who did better than last year or to the person who finished first?
So who's at the top of the health Olympics? Who's winning?
Turns out to be Japan. Most people don't think of Japan as the healthiest country in the world. And then when I point it out, they say, well, it must be their diet. But in 1960, the tables were turned. Japan was 23rd and we were 13th. So by 1978, Japan had pulled ahead in the Health Olympics race to be the healthiest country in the world. And it's been that way for almost 25 years. And so people say, well, it must be their diet. But their diet hasn't changed that much during that period of time. It must be that, they exercise. And yes, they do exercise, but that hasn't changed either. And then I ask some people who've been to Japan usually, well, what else do you notice in Japan? And some people will say, well, they smoke a lot. And then I point out, yes, as a matter of fact, Japan wins the gold medal in the smoking Olympics. That is, out of all the rich countries, nobody smokes as much as people in Japan. Men in Japan, twice as many men in Japan smoke as in America. Yet, the price they pay from lung cancer deaths, from heart disease deaths, from deaths that we know are attributable to smoking, they pay half the price. Think about it. They smoke twice as much and pay half the price. Now, I'm not suggesting that people go out and smoke, but I am suggesting that, and smoking isn't good for you in any population, the smokers are not going to be as healthy as the non-smokers, but compared to other things, smoking isn't that bad. As a doctor, I used to rail against my patients for smoking. I did everything I could to sort of humiliate them for smoking or tell them to stop smoking. Of course, they all knew that smoking wasn't good for them. But now I never tell some. I mean, I put it on the instructions just because that I give people, just because, of course, it is good health advice. But I blame myself for being a part of a society that doesn't share. And that the problem really is much more my problem than the person that smokes in America.
So in Japan, my understanding is that the difference between the wealthiest and the poorest is a little bit different than here in the U.S.?
Yes, Japan's a complex situation to try and understand. But basically, if you think of Japanese people, you don't think of Japanese individual. You think of groups of Japanese, right? Remember the last time you saw a bunch of Japanese traveling here in Seattle? You didn't see one person, you saw a whole group. And that's different. They think of themselves as one big family. And that means that the idea that somebody would make 500 times what an entry-level worker makes in his company is just anathema. Newsweek reports that they make 11 times what an entry-level worker. Sorry, Businessweek reports they make 11 times what an entry-level worker makes. And here in America, it's around 500 times, though 2 weeks ago in the New York Times magazine, Paul Krugman said that the new revised figure is 1,000 times. The boss makes 1,000 times what an entry-level worker makes. That's not very good for our health.
What are some of the factors you use for measuring the Health Olympics?
Well, it is this thing that's reported by every country, the life expectancy. Born today, today's mortality rates, how long can you expect to live? You could also use infant mortality. Out of 1,000 infants born this year, how many will die in their first year of life? And in that measure, we do just about as poorly. Namely, we're 25th in the Health Olympics. And the countries that are ahead of us, besides pretty well all the other rich countries, include some poor ones, Cyprus and Malta and Greece and Spain, and, you know, countries we don't necessarily associate with being very healthy. And just to the north of us is Canada, where Canada's number 7 in the Health Olympics. It's right up near the top. And it's not that much different than we are. At least some people feel that way. But on the other hand, it does have a social compact with the people. And is a much more sharing society. I should know. I was born in Toronto and grew up there.
Now, is it also because of their healthcare system there that they're healthier?
Yes. They don't spend as much money as we do, of course. But the important thing is that everybody has access to healthcare. And that, you know, healthcare doesn't have an awful lot to do with making a population healthy. I liken it to the Army Medical Corps. The Army Medical Corps doesn't decide whether we go to war or not. It doesn't decide the battle strategies, the ordnance, the weapons used, the protective devices used. It just goes in after, you know, it goes in and picks up the casualties and tries to do the best with them. That's the best we can expect of the healthcare system. It picks up the casualties of the battle. And so if you feel in America, as we have 45 million uninsured, if you feel that you can't have access to this system, you're going to be even worse off than if you, because of just how you feel that this is denied to you because you don't have enough money. Whereas every other rich country has a universal access healthcare system, and so people feel like, hey, my country cares for me, and I can have healthcare. It's also a way of redistribution. In other words, every society has rules on who gets what share of the pie. And if you have to pay for health services, then that's something that comes out of your pocket. But if everybody, it's decided that everybody has access to this service, then it's a way of redistributing funds or redistributing resources or wealth behind the scenes. In Canada, for example, you have universal coverage. Everybody has access. It's not a question of whether you can pay or not. And in the same way, you have education is much more heavily subsidized by the government. There are no private universities in Canada, for example. And the educational tuition fees are much, much less than here. And for public schools, for primary and secondary schools, the way in which they calculate how much money schools get is different. It's not based on the local county or city property tax allocations. It's based on a redistributive formula done at the provincial level. So that the province decides that schools in places that don't have high property taxes are going to have more funding than they would otherwise get if it was based on the formula we use in the United States.
How does the U.S. compare with Cuba in its health index?
Well, Cuba's 31st. It's just behind us. Now, some years it's been a little higher. It was about 29th or 28th a few years back. And Cuba's an interesting country because we've been strangling it for over 40 years. And yet, in this incredibly poor country that has had these sanctions imposed upon it for this length of time is almost as healthy as America. And, Cuban Minister of Health remarked to a visitor once, because Cuba's very poor, he said, we live like the poor, but we die like the rich. Because in any society, the rich are going to be healthier than the poor. And that's an important point. We tend to not think of the fact that it is the poor in America that pay a much greater price for in terms of poor health than the other segments of society.
What role does our for-profit healthcare system play in all this?
Well, I think just to step back and before we talk about our for-profit healthcare system, most people in America don't realize that at the government level, at the federal, state, county, and city level, the amount of money spent by the government per person in this country on health services is already greater than the per capita expenses in every other country on health care. So the government is already spending more than in any other country per person on health care. So if we wanted to have a system of providing health services through the government, we already have all the money we need being spent. So that then asks, well, what does for-profit do to that? Well, once you add in all the profits in this, of course, we can't possibly afford to provide this service for everybody because there's too much money to be, there's too many profits that would be lost in that process. I don't think that health services are the kind of thing that you should allocate by market mechanisms. No other country, all the other rich countries have in the past not done that, but one of the sort of aspects of globalization is that the rich people in other countries see that the American market mechanism for health services really creates wealth in the small segments of America that profit from health care, and so they want to emulate the American system. And so here we have this disaster here that other countries, that the leaders in other countries want to copy, and that's really not a very healthy situation. But I think the important thing to recognize is that American public, through surveys, have always wanted a universal coverage healthcare system. They don't like the idea of having to pay out of pocket or to have their insurance benefits through work regulated, so they are limited in what they can and can't do. 70% in many, many public opinion surveys, 60 to 70% of the public want a single-payer healthcare system. It's not on the agenda.
And is that because of the healthcare industry, the people that are profiting from this already, being effective in preventing that from happening?
That appears to be the case. They structure the debate so that you have a choice of this plan or that plan, and this is America where we all have choices, but it's the wrong question. They structure the debate not on whether we should have a universal coverage healthcare system, but do you want paper or plastic?
So would it be fair to say that in some ways our for-profit system is literally killing people?
Yes, you could certainly make that argument. The evidence linking health care input to health output, health is measured by life expectancy, infant mortality, is tenuous at best. And part of that is because there is this phenomenon that I call medical harm that works in medical care. We make mistakes, and we also do things that result in bad outcomes just because of the powerful forces that, the surgical procedures, the interventions, the drugs. Literally, when you look at it, so much of medical care does harm. And there have been several studies done in America showing a very high rate of deaths due to medical care. Sometimes these studies get on the front pages of the newspapers. For example, in 1998, in the New York Times front page, they reported that a study showed that over 107,000 people a year die in hospital from adverse reactions to prescription drugs. And the Institute of Medicine published a report entitled To Err is Human, That is, that mistakes that are made in medical care are a major cause of death in America. But mostly what we've done is set up quality control committees in hospitals to try and make sure that you spell the name of the drug right and the dose is right and these kinds of things, which are very important. I think that, we shouldn't neglect that. But at the same time, we need to sort of ask whether or not more medical care is really better for us. And all the studies seem to suggest that it's not. For example, when doctors go on strike, when doctors went on strike in Los Angeles County, for example, the anesthesiologists, because of high malpractice premiums, county coroner death rates dropped. When doctors went on a strike in Bogota, Colombia, for 52 days, death rates dropped. We find this kind of situation that when we withdraw what we think is absolutely life-sustaining and necessary for our survival, we don't sort of start dropping dead. The opposite seems to be true. This is a really a paradox for, somebody like me who actually works clinically as a doctor to try and confront. And so I'm often asking myself, should I do something or should I just stand there? And sometimes it's better to say, don't just do something, stand there. And offer compassion and offer concern and all. But if more is not going to necessarily help this person, don't do it.
So do you find yourself as a doctor then battling this for-profit system that seems to, from my perception, seems to say you need to crank out, you know, so many prescriptions a year, you need to use our new type of machine and incorporate that into your daily routine? Is that a serious amount of pressure there?
Fortunately, not for me, because I think if it was, I would probably find something else to do. By working in emergency rooms and emergency departments, thank God, one of the things that we can't do in emergency departments is turn people away. We have to see everybody. And and you don't have these influences. You really try and do what you think is best. Though, we get more and more sophisticated tests, and we tend to think that they're better. And but at least in the situation that I work in, I have the ability to sort of work independently and think, what is really best for the particular patient that I'm seeing? I ask other people's advice. I keep in touch with the studies and the literature. There probably are subliminal influences in which I want to use the newest and latest procedures, but I try to temper that and think, what's really going to benefit the patient and what studies do we have out there to influence my decisions? There is this whole force right now in healthcare called evidence-based medicine. In the past, we thought of medicine or the art of medicine as an art. What doctors did was sort of a mixture of art and science. And there is this push to try and get more of the scientific studies influencing the day-to-day decisions that you make regarding the care of your patient. And that's a difficult situation because the studies really don't answer most of the specific questions that you're confronted with when you see a particular patient in the ER, for example. But you try to make everything as evidence-based as possible, but that is a major recent thrust in health services in America.
And then do you have to contend with a lot of those studies seem fairly rigged on some of them for particular company produces a particular drug and, you know, they produce several studies to support that their drug is safe, but we don't know how many of other studies were done where had bad results and then they pulled that study completely. Is that something that's in the back of your mind?
Oh, there's an awful lot of that. When you publish an article, you're supposed to disclose your conflict of interests, whether you are paid for by the drug company and whatnot. And it's despicable the ways that people get around that. For example, there was a recent study in the most prestigious medical journal in America, the New England Journal of Medicine, and it was about a study comparing drugs for psychiatric conditions. And it was a long article, and it was very interesting. And it had many, many authors. It was a multi-center study. And at the end, they for the disclosure of conflict of interest, they said that there were two. It was too long to list in the printed version of the journal. Go to the journal's website. Well, if you went to the journal's website, first of all, you had to pay to get that information. You had to be a subscriber to the web part of the journal. And when you looked it up, it was huge. I mean, there were so many conflicts of interest among all the authors. They all were paid for, but they were all employed by the drug companies. And of course, you know, who pays the piper calls the tune. And you may not think of it directly that way, but it works subliminally. There's no question about that.
So you said that working in the ER, you're not necessarily so affected by a lot of this pressures from the for-profit industry. Do you think out in the bigger industry itself, though, that those pressures are greater?
Well, there's a new phenomenon that's happened in the last couple of years in America, and that's to direct-to-consumer advertising. I grew up in the era where doctors never advertised. They had a non-bold-faced one-line listing in the telephone book about, you know, Dr. So-and-so, and that was it. And now advertising is everywhere, not just doctors offering to change the shape of your body to make you have erections and everything else, but they are offering, but people are advertising, the drug companies are advertising drugs and basically building in a nag factor. They tell you, go to your doctor and nag the doctor to give you this drug. And then, of course, they have this long list of adverse effects that they're required to print. But this works. People, you know, it's so much easier to just write the prescription for the darn drug than to talk to the patient about how it won't necessarily help them and could even harm them. It's much easier to, you know, the patient will be happier, the drug company will be happier, you'll have more time to spend with more patients, which is what the system does. It wants you to see people quickly. And I don't think many people benefit except the pharmaceutical companies that have profit margins that are much greater than all the other industries.
Yeah, I found that very intriguing. In the last couple of years, the number, for instance, just during the nightly news, the national news, they'll have in any given half hour at least half a dozen different ads for these prescription drugs. And sometimes they don't even tell you what this drug does. They just, you know, have some people dancing about and they're happy and they look like, you know, you want to join their crowd. And right. To do so, ask your doctor about so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that really disturbing.
It is. Unfortunately, it's going to become a more common practice in other countries too, because the drug companies are seeing that, you know, they can increase sales tremendously by this. One of the things that we don't realize is that drug companies spend far more money on marketing products than they do on research. You know, they always say we need to do all this to be able to spend all this money on basic research for these great pharmaceuticals. But in fact, you know, the data suggests otherwise. They probably spend 10 times as much money on marketing as they do on basic research. And actually, the research is mostly making copies of drugs, Me Too drugs. You know, if somebody has a, you know, there's going to be a new Viagra coming out by other companies because, you know, they can just find a slightly different chemical formulation that will do the same thing, and then they can get into the market too. Most of the basic research we actually is funded by the National Institutes of Health and by the government. We actually pay for it. And, you know, so the costs of the research are socialized, but then we give the opportunity to make profits to the to the drug companies without paying a license to the people for this, for having funded the basic research. So we socialize costs and privatize profits.
Yeah, and that doesn't even go into all the race towards changing, going to these third world nations and grabbing their natural remedies and stuff, mm-hmm. and slapping mm-hmm. patents on that as quickly mm-hmm. as they can and trying to profit off of that. We only have a couple minutes left, and I know you're going to be talking this weekend as part of a talk on NAFTA.
Actually, yes, it's the Free Trade Area of the Americas, the FTAA. And this is the sequel to NAFTA. Basically, right now in Quito, Ecuador, there is a meeting of all the Western Hemisphere countries, including our U.S. trade representative, that are trying to make these free trade agreements among all the countries in the Americas. So it's as an attempt to carry on the Battle of Seattle that happened in November of 1999, we have a conference at the School of Social Work at the University of Washington both today and tomorrow on all of these issues. And And so I try to make the links between globalization and health and suggest that the FTAA is killing us. That is, what is free trade doing? In any studies, free trade seems to increase the gap between the rich and the poor. So that has a direct health impact. And so we have actually seen this as we've seen more and more free trade issues come about. Free trade, of course, is a misnomer. It really is corporate-centered trade. But as we have more and more of this corporate-centered trade going on, it increases the gaps between the rich and the poor, and you actually see adverse health effects of that. The most egregious example has been in the former Soviet Union. Most people are not aware that when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1992 and they jump-started to a capitalist system, the gap between the rich and the poor just increased immensely overnight, and all sorts of Soviet nomenclatura made it onto the Forbes billionaire list. And what happened to life expectancy in Russia? It dropped 7 years, and in other communist countries too. Now, health has kept on improving all of the last century except in two instances, and one is sub-Saharan Africa due to AIDS in the last decade, and the other one was the incredible health decline in the countries of the former Soviet Union. And the number of excess deaths there number somewhere between 15 and 20 million people have died because the life expectancy has dropped so rapidly. And that is really due to the same kinds of issues that are being debated in the free trade area of the Americas.
So, Stephen, thank you for coming in this morning. It's been enlightening.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk, Mike.
Just been talking with Dr. Stephen Bezrushka, who is a teacher here and at the University of Washington. And also,
I'm an emergency doc at a couple of local hospitals.
That was Dr. Stephen Bezrushka speaking with Mike McCormick in Seattle last month. Next, some medicinal laughter from the CCCP, the Christmas Coup Comedy Players of WBAI in New York City.
We now take you live to the Oval Office, where National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice and Vice President Dick Cheney are waiting for the President to arrive for their early morning briefing.
What is delaying the President this morning, Condi?
He told me he was eating breakfast when I got here an hour ago, Dick.
Well, I hope he's not taking advice from the orange juice carton.
What advice, Dick?
Oh, it's a moron joke, Condi. Why did the moron take an hour to eat breakfast?
Because it said concentrate on the side of the orange juice kind of carton?
Yeah, That's it.
Mr. President.
Oh, Mr. President. Yeah. Morning.
Condi, Dick, sit down.
Oh, thank you.
You two look worried already. Very worried, freaked out this morning.
Well,
what's going on?
Oh, well, no, we're not freaked out, Mr. President.
No, Mr. President is just concerned.
Well, I used to worry early in the morning myself.
Yeah.
You know, when I used to rush through breakfast. No. To rush through it. Eat it right down.
Yeah.
10 minutes. Maybe 5 minutes.
Oh.
On a really bad day, I could eat breakfast in about 20 seconds.
Oh my God.
Then about a week ago, I happened to notice something written on an orange juice carton, and it seemed to give me some good advice.
Oh.
You found good advice on an orange juice carton, Mr. President?
Well, it sounds like a joke.
This is no joke.
Oh, yes, Mr. President.
On the side of the orange juice carton, it said, concentrate.
Concentrate, yes, and pay attention.
No, Condi, it just says, concentrate.
Oh.
And now I do. That's what I concentrate. That's why it takes me an hour to eat breakfast, because I concentrate. That's how I get my best ideas. This morning, by the way, while concentrating, it occurred to me that I could send fighter jets to bomb the Canadian side of Niagara Falls. And so I did.
You attacked Canada, Mr. President?
Well, I'm sure they deserved it, Mr. President.
You bet. Of course they deserved it. Yeah. Director of Communications for Canada, the Prime Minister there, whatever his name is, Cretan or Cretan or something,
yes,
like that, whatever he's got a name that begins with a C.
Mm-hmm.
Not concentrate, but it begins with a C.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it means concentrate, so I did. But anyway, the person that works for this man called me some name that I view as negative. It has a negative connotation to it. She called me, now get this, a moron.
Oh, well, we oppose name-calling, Mr. President.
Yeah. Anyone who does it is a jerk.
Absolutely.
For purposes of fostering a better world image for myself and United States, as I said, United States, I have decided to prove to the world that I'm not a moron.
Well, let me know if I can be of any help, Mr. President.
You know, they say it's hard to prove a negative, Mr. President.
I'm not going to prove a negative, Dick.
Huh?
Understand that?
No.
I'm going to prove that I'm not a moron.
I see.
Perhaps we could get the Supreme Court to issue a decree saying you are not a moron.
I don't want to push my luck with the Supreme Court.
Well, better safe than sorry.
I can't have them ruling 5-4 that I'm a moron or that I'm not a moron.
No,
I'm sure we could get 6-3, Mr. President.
I'm taking another route, Condi.
Ah.
Dick, the FBI tells me you have an extensive collection of moron jokes.
Well, yes, I do, Mr. President.
Seems like a strange thing to collect, Dick.
Well,
I did not have time to make an extensive study of the moron joke when I was a student. I was doing too much cocaine then, okay?
Yeah.
But I know by, LSD as well.
Yes.
That's when I really couldn't concentrate. But I know by the few moron jokes that I do know that I'm not a moron.
Well, that's good.
Certainly not, Mr. President.
Okay? Here's what we do.
What?
We check out each other, okay? Each and every moron joke we can, and get our hands on it.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone that's out there.
Yeah.
And then figure out how to prove that it doesn't apply to me,
well,
George W. Bush.
Okay. We will clear your name, Mr. President.
Please. Condi, have you ever seen me throw a clock out the window?
Well, I never saw you throw anything out the window, Mr. President.
A clock, Condi.
Oh.
Not throwing a clock out the window proves then I'm not a moron.
That's right. The moron threw the clock out the window because he wanted to see time fly.
I don't care what the moron wanted to see, Dick.
No,
I don't care what the hell he wanted to see.
No.
Not throwing a clock out the window proves that I'm not a moron because I never threw out a clock.
See,
so.
It's
That's
definitive
right.
proof and completely unneeded.
Right.
I have never needed, okay?
Right.
I have never tiptoed past the medicine cabinet, okay? Mm. Never tiptoed.
No.
That proves I'm not a moron.
Certainly does, Mr. President.
Well, you don't need any more proof than that, Mr. President.
I don't tiptoe. Never have.
You
ever.
Are, no, you...
I've never tiptoed.
You are not a tiptoer, Mr. President.
And besides, you can't wake up a sleeping pill. I happen to know that.
That's right, Mr. President.
I've taken plenty of my lifetime when I was doing a lot of cocaine to put myself to sleep so I could wake up and do some more cocaine. So you can't wake up a sleeping pill.
No, no, it can't happen, Mr. President. Mm-hmm. And the moron thought it could.
Yes.
Okay,
that's the point,
a pill is an inanimate object. You see how I was able to pronounce that word?
Yeah.
Inanimate compound made of chemicals and stuff.
Mm.
A lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Okay? Would a moron know that?
Well, a moron wouldn't even have a clue, Mr. President.
A moron wouldn't understand chemistry.
A moron wouldn't even know the meaning of H2O.
Is that a new secret code or something? H2O? That's a secret code, right? Secret code.
It's water, Mr. President.
Uh-huh. What?
Water.
Yeah. I don't like lightning.
I don't either, Mr. President.
Well, no one likes lightning.
A moron does. Oh. He thinks someone has taken his picture.
Well, it
proves... Okay, so I don't like lightning.
Well, that definitely proves you're not a moron, Mr. President.
I have never climbed a glass wall to see what's on the other side.
That's a good point, Mr. President.
Exactly.
Yes.
Okay, if I wanted to see what was on the other side of a glass wall, I would hit it with a big sledgehammer and smash it to bits. In case of emergency, of course, I'd break the glass.
Well, it's why you are the president.
They wanted to confuse a moron, so they put him in a round room and told him to sit in one corner. Okay?
Yeah.
The people put me in a round room. They put me in a round room. It's called the Oval Office.
That's right.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
I sit at a desk. I don't have time to look for a corner in that Oval Office, and it's always been oval, ever since I've been there.
And a president is busy.
Yes.
I have discovered that my AM radio is broadcasting in the PM as well as in the AM.
Really?
I discovered it.
No.
Both AM, PM, I discovered this myself. This is also what the moron discovered about his AM radio, okay?
Yeah. Right, no,
but the moron didn't know what to do about it, and I do.
What?
I know about it, okay?
What?
I am ordering the FCC to mandate that round-the-clock AM stations reclassify themselves as AM/PM stations.
Well, you've made radio honest, Mr. President.
I can almost walk on water, Condi, especially when I'm doing acid.
Mr. President, what do you do if a moron throws a grenade at you?
I'd kill the son of a bitch.
Well,
you'd be within your rights, Mr. President.
Well, how would you kill him, Mr. President?
I would drop an atomic bomb on the place of his birth and pours in the reservoir that supplies water to his place of residence. What are you, foolish?
No.
Come on.
This is good thinking, Mr.
Yes,
President.
Well, you know, if a moron throws a grenade at you, Mr. President, you are supposed to pull the pin and throw it back at him.
Only a real moron would do that, Dick.
Well, this is just a joke.
If a moron throws a grenade at me as a president of the United States, I cannot consider that a joke. I can't consider it a joke.
It is a crime to throw anything at an elected government official.
Yeah, but the moron doesn't pull the pin.
Still a crime.
Well, maybe the moron is a moron who already heard this moron joke, about the moron and the grenade. Yeah. So he gets a booby-trapped grenade that goes off when you pull the pin.
A moron who could devise such a plan wouldn't be a moron.
No, he'd be a mad genius.
I devised that plan.
Oh. Proof, once and for all, that you are not a moron, Mr. President.
Well, perhaps we should call off that air attack on Niagara Falls now, then.
The war with Canada shall continue.
Oh.
I have decided that maple syrup is an illegal drug.
All right.
And I'm asking each and every loyal American to sneak into Canada and kill a maple tree. Remember, somebody does maple trees, maple syrup, pancakes, you are helping out a terrorist.
Yeah, that's a good point.
We could send in the Peace Corps with hypodermic syringes filled with arsenic.
Okay, are we finished here?
Just one more thing, Mr. President. We recently discovered that what we thought was the religious rights list of top 10 candidates for the job of investigating the 9/11 tragedy with Henry Kissinger at the top was actually their worst 10 list.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Their worst 10 list? You're not telling me this now.
It was overlooked at first that the second and third choices on that list were Charles Manson and Alec Baldwin.
It's too late. I already appointed Kissinger.
Well, no one will notice.
Do you know what happened to the moron ice hockey team, by the way?
They drowned in spring training, Dick.
Yeah.
I did not hear of that tragedy. You want to elaborate?
Well, it's a joke, Mr. President.
They didn't know the ice would melt. Hmm? Huh?
If they were an ice hockey team from Canada, hey, I'm kind of glad that they drowned.
That was the Christmas Coup Comedy Players. For more on the CCCP, visit their website at christmascoup.com. That's coup spelled C-O-U-P. Another factor that affects our health in modern society, in spite of improvements in personal lifestyles and medical treatments, is toxic pollution of the environment. The proliferation of toxics is directly tied to corporate profit-making activities, and corporations have fought like tigers against anti-pollution regulations. The usual complaint is that the regulations are too costly to the corporate profit margin. What about the lives of the people impacted by their waste? On December 13th, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund reported on a small town in Pennsylvania that's fighting back. They wrote, "The elected municipal officials of Porter Township, Clarion County, a municipality of 1,500 residents an hour north of Pittsburgh in northwestern Pennsylvania, became the first local government in the United States to eliminate corporate claims to civil and constitutional privileges. The township adopted a binding law declaring that corporations operating in the township may not wield legal privileges, historically used by corporations to override democratic decision-making, to stop the township from passing laws which protect residents from toxic sewage sludge. The actions by Porter Township taken December 9th thus repudiate the history of state and federal public officials restricting the rights of citizens while expanding the rights of corporations and their owners. Along with close to a dozen other municipal governments in Pennsylvania, Porter Township officials had previously adopted a local law governing the land application of sewage sludge in the township. The adoption of that municipal law was an outgrowth of the work done by residents and municipal officials to stop sewage sludge corporations from dumping Pittsburgh-generated sludge in the township. To that immediate end, the municipal government adopted a tipping fee law that requires corporate sludge haulers to pay a per-ton tipping fee to the township to enable the municipality to verify the safety of each load of sludge applied to land. Sludge corporations have responded both legislatively and judicially to the adoption of those laws by Pennsylvania municipalities, which prevent corporations from turning to state and federal officials to override local self-governance. In 2000, Sinagro Corporation, one of the largest sludge hauling corporations in the United States, sued township officials in Center County, Pennsylvania, in an attempt to overturn the tipping fee law adopted by that township. In their complaint, the corporation alleged that the law violated a litany of civil and constitutional rights asserted by the corporation. A ruling by the federal courts is expected by 2004. Legislatively, sludge corporations drafted and vigorously pushed bills that would strip Pennsylvania municipalities of their authority to make rules that would control the land application of sewage sludge and factory farms. A unique coalition of groups that included municipal governments, the Pennsylvania Farmers Union, the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture, the Sierra Club, the AFL-CIO, the United Mine Workers of America, Common Cause and others defeated that legislation at the end of the 2002 legislative session. In addition to the legislative and judicial responses to the assertion of local democracy by communities, sludge corporations have also instructed the State Environmental Regulatory Agency and corporate farm lobbies to intervene with Clarion County townships. In late 2002, the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection and the Pennsylvania Farm Bureau met with Clarion County townships to convince them to repeal their local laws. The four Clarion County townships that have adopted the law refused. Instead, Porter Township forged ahead with adopting the most recent law, which eliminates corporate interference in the democratic processes of the township. Also late in 2002, the Alcosan Corporation, a sludge-hauling corporation in Pennsylvania, threatened to use Pennsylvania courts to overturn the sludge law passed by the township. Porter Township supervisors, upon learning of the ability of corporations to direct the courts to vindicate corporate claims to civil and legal privileges to override local governments, decided to pass a law to eliminate corporate claims to those rights. The actions of Porter Township, along with the actions of other municipal governments in Pennsylvania dealing with land-applied sewage sludge and factory farms, evidence the shift of communities away from permitting corporate harms to asserting direct control over corporations. The sludge and corporate personhood ordinances were developed by the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund in partnership with the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, POCLAD, and communities across Pennsylvania impacted by land-applied sewage sludge and corporate factory farms. For more information on the movement to restore citizen authority over corporations, visit www.reclaimdemocracy.org.
There's a corporation having a hard time finding cheap labor, or paying too much money for foreign men of the rights, maybe experiencing delays in weapons delivery or resistance to toxic dumping. It's time you call Kissinger and Associates. From El Salvador to Zaire to Indonesia, Kissinger and Associates has the connection for your protection from third world rejection. We guarantee to find you the right labor, land, and laws for maximum profit. Call our toll-free number now, 1-800-CARNAGE. That's 1-800-GARNAGE.
Watergate, they both would pray, but oh. Nixon had his Watergate too. Nixon's crimes, they took him down. But Kissinger is still around. This is W. Henry Fine. Someone to blame for 9/11. It smears my name. If you put me in your cabinet kitchen, we'll blame it all on Christopher Hitchens. Make him confess. Don't let him say no to you. Remember the secret bombing of Cambodia? That was on me. My big war crime. And I never did one day of time. Don't worry about me. No, don't be silly. Remember what I did in Chile. Took Allende down one day and replaced him with old Pinochet. To Indonesia we sent guns. It's not our fault if they're a bunch of bums. I sent them in to East Timor, where they carried out a genocidal war. And don't forget the Argentine. Yes, that was me. That was all mine. And it was me who engineered the 100,000 disappeared. What do you say to the accusation that you are just a genocidal jerk? I repeat, covert operations are not to be confused with missionary work.
The CCCP's Richard Corey and Moogie Klingwin with the Ballad of Henry Kissinger. Several years ago, Argentina was being hailed as an economic miracle. It was no more miraculous than a team of pickpockets working a crowd. Thanks to Kissinger and his associates, that nation was subjected first to a military dictatorship, then a transition to a so-called democracy that from the outset was held hostage by international finance capital. The so-called investors, more appropriately called gamblers and bandits, bought up the country's publicly owned assets, which were sold at bargain prices under the direction of the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. While the looting was in full swing, the stock market was up, and thus a great success for speculators, hence the economic miracle. Then they took their money and ran, leaving the citizens of Argentina to clean up the mess. Over the past year, outraged Argentines have been taking matters into their own hands, bringing down government after government with spirited street protests and blockades. Their federal government seems incapable of doing anything but taking more of the hair of the IMF dog. As in our previous story about Clarion County, Pennsylvania, local government in Argentina is responding to grassroots initiatives at social resuscitation. This story was published in the Sydney Morning Herald on November 9th. It's titled, "Worker Control Breathes Life into Ailing Factories." Reed Lindsay reports from Buenos Aires on a rare and controversial success story amid the ruins of Argentina's economy. For nearly a year, the workers at the Grissinopoli breadstick factory saw their weekly salary steadily decline from 150 pesos to 100 and then to 40. Finally, on June 3rd, with the firm headed for bankruptcy, the workers demanded recompense. The plant manager offered 10 pesos to each of the 14 employees and asked them to leave the factory. They didn't budge. "He closed the shutters and we stayed inside," said Norma Pintos, 49, who's worked at the factory in the middle-class Chacarita neighborhood for 11 years. "We just wanted to keep coming to work." But what began as a last-ditch effort to save their jobs, or at the very least receive some back wages, turned into a dogged effort to gain control of the factory. The workers began taking turns guarding the factory 24 hours a day, surviving by asking for spare change at the public university and selling empanadas, chorizos, and homemade bread on the street. 4 months later, the city legislature expropriated the factory and handed it over to the workers. In October, Gersonopoli began producing breadsticks again. In little more than a year, workers have seized control of scores of foundering factories across Argentina. Even more remarkable than the takeovers has been the worker-led resuscitation of the factories, which in some cases are doing better than under their previous ownerships. Apart from saving thousands of jobs and softening the precipitous decline of the nation's once formidable industrial production, the factory takeovers are defying hard and fast notions about the relationship between capital and labor. They've also begun to alarm conservatives, who view them as threatening private property rights. But in this crisis-laden nation of 37 million, where more than half the population is below the poverty line and 34% of the workforce is unemployed or underemployed, the workers have won government sanction and strong public support. As darkness descends over the murky Riachuelo River that marks Buenos Aires' southern boundary, the nearby Gelco ice cream factory still hums with activity. Men in green uniforms mop floors while others sort papers in the front office. In February, the owners of the factory, once the nation's leading maker of the flavored powder used in making ice cream, locked the doors and soon afterwards filed for bankruptcy. The workers, who were owed the equivalent of thousands of dollars in back wages and benefits, were left to fend for themselves as they awaited the outcome of a long and uncertain legal process. At the urging of Luis Caro, a lawyer who has represented some 40 occupied factories, the workers formed a cooperative and mounted a permanent protest in front of the factory, preventing attempts to remove any equipment or inventory. After 3 months, the bankruptcy judge allowed them temporarily to rent the factory. In September, the Buenos Aires legislature expropriated Gelco, the first seizure of its kind in the city, and handed the keys to the cooperative. Now 43 of Gelco's former employees, all of whom worked on the factory floor, run the company. While they say they enjoy working for themselves, bringing the company back to life has not been easy. Many are working 12-hour days as they juggle new managerial or administrative duties with their former production posts. "Before, when it was time to leave, we were out the door. Now it's 9 at night and we're still here," said Claudia Pea, who labels containers and cleans the bathrooms when she's not greeting customers and clients as a receptionist. Across the Riachuelo in the province of Buenos Aires, business is booming for the 54 members of the Union and Force Cooperative, who occupied a metallurgical plant for 6 months before securing legal control through an expropriation last year. The workers are earning more than twice as much as they did as employees, and are set to take on 20 new members, almost all of them sons of current workers. With demand high for their copper and brass pipes and taps, they are expanding the plant and have plans to export their products. The workers are as surprised as anyone else at the factory's success. "The fellows still think this is all a dream," said the cooperative's president, Roberto Salcedo, 49. "Nowadays, if you lose your job, you know that you aren't going to find work again, and much less at our age." If shrewd industrialists with an open credit line ran these companies into bankruptcy, how can worker-controlled cooperatives with no capital and no business experience be thriving during the worst economic slump in Argentina's history? Having the books wiped clean of old debts has not hurt. But more important, the workers say, are the profits freed by eliminating the owner's hefty take and the higher salaries paid to managerial staff.